Welcome to Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Each week, we dissect the news with experienced journalists from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Filling in for me as host this week is Chris Sapone. I'll hand you over to him. Thanks, Chris.
This is Please Explain. I'm Chris Sapone. The ecological effects of this bushfire season have been devastating. More than a billion animals have perished, and the wider environmental impacts are still being assessed. But from these images of destruction, the tide is turning. Public opinion is changing, and just this week, an Ipsos poll found that the environment is the biggest issue confronting and worrying Australians. Welcome to part 5 of our summer series on climate change and weather with Peter Hannam. This week, we're looking at the state of our wildlife, especially in the wake of the blazes that have burned about 10 million hectares so far. And the season is far from over. Joining environment editor Peter Hannam is Laura Chung, who's usually the Sydney Morning Herald's urban affairs reporter, but she's been on the ground this summer, reporting from the bushfires around New South Wales. Welcome, Peter and Laura. Thanks for joining me on Please Explain. Now, Peter, what impact have the bushfires had on the environment so far?
Well, obviously, the fires are still going. The numbers are huge any way you look at it. But we're talking about effectively 1.5 Tasmanias have burned this fire season. So the 10 million hectares plus, about half of that is in New South Wales. Queensland's had about 2.5 million hectares burned. Victoria, about 1.4 million. And places such as South Australia, where there's about 500,000 hectares burned, about nearly half of that is on Kangaroo Island itself. So we're seeing really huge numbers in terms of hectares. And as the different states look at the early response, when they finally can get people out into the field, they'll find out just, you know, how bad various species have been hit. But the early summaries from the states and from the Commonwealth, we're really talking about dozens of threatened species having almost all, if not all, of their known rangelands actually burnt during this season's fires.
Now, Laura, you were out on the fire grounds as the fires were unfolding this summer. Can you sort of paint a picture of what you saw as these fires were raging?
Absolutely. So as Peter said, the scale of it is huge. And I think that's what's so important to keep in mind. It doesn't matter where you go. The situation is always the same. You know, it's always really hot. It's always really smoky. The smoke stings your eyes and your throat. But I think what really surprised me was the lack of animals I saw out there. We did see some kangaroos bounding away from the fires and some insects kind of scuttling away kind of in the hours before the fire would sweep through. But there were very few birds. There was just this really eerie silence as the fireys and the residents and I guess, you know, the whole area is just kind of waited for this fire to sweep through.
Laura, can you tell us specifically where were you reporting from?
So I've spent a couple of weeks on the road and we've been travelling, you know, around New South Wales, but spent a lot of time in the Blue Mountains town of Bilpin. And this community is quite used to seeing fire. They're generally very prepared for it. You know, they've seen it in 2013 and 2016, but this year was unlike anything they'd ever seen. We've also spent quite a bit of time in the Snowy Mountains as well, and particularly in really badly hit areas such as Buxton and Bargo down in the Southern Highlands.
So I had a couple of stints as well. One was on the south coast of New South Wales. And actually coming back, we drove through forests which had virtually been entirely incinerated near Braidwood. And one of the sort of eerie center feelings you get when you drive through that is like nothing is moving. It's so quiet. You're lucky to see maybe a wallaby and a joey, which, you know, is almost certainly finished because there's no food. So where's it going to go? But I was also up in the Blue Mountains, which about 80% of that area is burned, up near Nunes. And one of the striking sort of visions we had kind of leaving this area was just how much wildlife was right beside the road, days perhaps just chewing on whatever remaining grass there was, but really just ignoring humans, whether it was wombats or kangaroos, etc. And you could almost walk up to them. It was very unusual. This is not how wildlife normally behaves. See humans, they're usually bounding away as fast as they can go. So that sort of mix of how quiet everything was, But even what's there is, you know, pretty much stunned.
Those are some remarkable images. And so, Peter, with these massive and devastating losses, specifically, what kind of species do we anticipate have been affected?
A lot of people will see the koalas as often featured in the media, but in fact, it's the lesser-known fauna that includes, for instance, the long-footed potoroo or the brush-tailed rock wallabies, which really only had very few in the wild to start with and hardly seen at all beforehand. Now they're going to be much harder to find. But the greater loss is probably going to be in the flora, because there's many species which will be burned, not very well known, not very well studied. It's actually in those kind of ecosystem underpinning plants which will probably see some of the greatest impacts. And, you know, they won't be missed because they were hardly known in the first case.
Now, Laura, you have been out there reporting from the field. The public has been moved by what they've seen. Can you talk about some of the responses that you've seen to the reporting that you've done?
Absolutely. So I guess we've all seen those images of injured native wildlife, and these have been broadcast all over the world. You know, they include a grandmother taking off her shirt and wrapping up this little koala as it's kind of on the road being surrounded by fire. So animal rescue organisations have received a flood of donations. For example, the Port Macquarie Koala Hospital has surpassed $7 million in donations. There are also stories of people sewing and knitting pouches for animals, of children holding their own bake sales on the sides of roads in major capital cities, and there are vets who are coming over from New Zealand to Australia, basically travelling around the country and just going to triage centres and doing whatever they can. So there are these stories of the community coming together and feeling this need to help and essentially doing whatever they can. I think something that's really important and interesting that's come up is particularly New South Wales and Victoria had these really severe droughts prior to the bushfires. And so a lot of farmers out there were already struggling to keep their livestock alive and find the hay and the water needed. So for a lot of the farmers we've spoken to, they've either had to sell off their cattle already or are just trying to, you know, find enough hay and enough fodder and enough water to keep their animals alive. So we're also seeing a lot of farmers in other states like Tasmania and Queensland and South Australia organising these hay bale runs to try and help out, you know, their friends.
Now, as far as wild animals go, when the fires begin, do they have a chance of actually fleeing them or do they end up caught up in the fires themselves?
It depends how fast a fire sweeps through the area and the ferocity of it. So in some places you go and visit, there's just nothing. There's, you know, the tree trunk, but there are no leaves. There's nothing on the ground. There might be a couple of rocks, but you can just tell that the fire has swept through with such high intensity that nothing had a chance. In places like this, we'll never really know, you know, what the true extent of the damage was, and we can safely assume that the animals had very little chance. But in other areas, you know, there is a possibility for them to seek shelter elsewhere.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor, vessel, Pong, Sue, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator, and mateship.
Flag of my honour is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue on your favourite podcast app.
Now, in the course of this massive sort of unfolding story, one story that's come out is that of the Woolamai Pines. Peter, can you talk a little bit about these pines and why they're so special and the sort of response that reporting about these pines has received?
Yes, so these pines, they've been dubbed dinosaur trees because until they were discovered in the wild in the 1990s, they were only seen in the fossil records from about 100 to 200 million years ago. So, of course, when a canyonist who was also a national parks worker stumbled upon them in 1994, it did create quite a sensation. So anyway, the location's been kept secret all those years. Some bushwalkers have kind of clued in, I suppose, where these pines are. But nevertheless, this particular species, it's been cloned ever since. But the original location, that was given a priority for the fire services to protect. And so they winched in firefighters ahead of the fire in the Woolamai National Park. They introduced sprinklers and other devices and sprayed retardant on nearby areas to try to keep the fire at bay. And in fact, for the greatest part, they did save perhaps the bulk of these trees, some 200 of them. So anyway, once that information was confirmed, the government of New South Wales put out some information, some imagery, and also some video of just how they went about saving it, and indeed how close the fires got. That created quite a sensation, if you like, globally. Certainly a huge response to the articles that we ran in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, for example. And since then, I understand, you know, great interest in following what happens next. But the key thing is that the original setting, which wasn't just only the pines that's been saved, but all the other, that ecosystem, which probably contains many organisms that work together, not well understood, and that, for the most part, is intact as well.
So this story, because of its scope, it's generated a real level of global awareness. Woolamai pines is one example, but also the iconic images of these koalas and wallabies that are fleeing or that are suffering. Do you think that this is creating a sort of moment of international awareness about climate change that is shifting in some way?
Well, it gets people's attention, not only the sort of evacuating holidaymakers, which is not normally the impression of summer in Australia. That obviously came in at a time of possibly a lull in global news around the new year. So it was bound to get quite a lot of attention, just the intense fires, the scale of them and so forth. But I think it's pretty interesting to see the response, particularly to the sort of wildlife articles and so on that we've written, as have others, that there was such an outpouring of interest. And perhaps people realized that many of the predictions about where climate change was going to be taking, you know, us in places like Australia, they're sort of coming to pass. Now, obviously, it's quite a complex subject, but there's no doubt that in the last 3 or 4 decades, southeastern Australia, southwestern Australia, they've been drying out during the winter months, background temperatures are warming. Australia just had its hottest and driest year on record. And you put those sort of trends together, and the chances of these enormous fires that we've just seen obviously increase with the climate change. And of course, the expectation in the future that those trends are actually going to continue, particularly on the temperature front. So it brought that kind of anxiety, if you like, to a head.
And Laura, what is your take on this?
What's really interesting is, as Peter was saying, you know, so many people have seen these images of koalas in the wildlife and really used those to personify what is happening out there and try and make sense of it. But the bushfires continue to rage, and at the same time we've had these massive hailstorms that have hit Canberra and surrounds. So I think for a lot of people, this fire season has really shown what is happening out there, and a lot of people are trying to use the weather events to kind of push the conversation towards climate change and action that is needed.
As Laura said early on, the fires came as the drought was intensifying. Now that the rains are coming in different parts after the fires, there's a lot of ash, sediment, and the rest of it will wash into the streams and possibly reservoirs, you know, supporting cities such as Sydney. And I was speaking to an ecologist just this morning, actually, from northern New South Wales up in the Bellinger River catchment. And he was saying that snapping turtle, which is critically endangered, had been reintroduced to try to, you know, into its habitat to really keep a viable population going. This particular waterway is so pristine, typically. The visibility is like tens of meters, apparently, in its normal condition. After the rains have washed the sediment and the ash in, it's down to like 10 centimeters. So these turtles are going to struggle to find the insects and you know, the weeds and so on that it would normally eat. And that is going to be multiplied, amplified, for many species. In some ways, the catastrophe that's been brought by these bushfires for the wildlife has got a long way to go, and we're not really sure just how serious it's going to get.
And Laura, is that what you've seen in your time reporting, these sorts of challenges facing both the flora and fauna of Australia?
Absolutely. And I think, what's so important to bear in mind is, while we've had rain across the nation this week, the RFS has warned that the fire season is by no means over. We're still in the peak of summer. We've still got a really long way to go. And they're urging people to not become complacent. Speaking about regeneration, I was up in the Blue Mountains town of Bilpin about a month after this really intense fire swept through the area. And, we're walking around in the bush, just trying to get an idea of what sort of devastation is out there. And already you can see these really little red buds poking through the burnt trunks of these eucalyptus trees. The further into the bush you go, you can see that people have put bird feeders on the trees. You can see little sweet potatoes in the branches that people have put there for the native animals to come and feed on, because there isn't anything left out there. So I think that certainly, while these fires have been really, really intense, we are slowly starting to see the ecosystems start to recover. And I guess it highlights why the work of places like Royal Botanical Gardens of Sydney is so important. So they've actually been preparing for this possibility for about 10 years by collecting the seeds of threatened species. And their plan is to use these seeds to propagate plants in fire-affected areas.
It's remarkable. So we talked a lot about the ecological impact of these ongoing fires. Can you talk a little bit about the politics and if there's any reason to have any optimism?
On that particular issue, if you remember a couple of years ago, we had back-to-back mass bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef, which killed about half of the cover of the Great Barrier Reef, the corals. Now, did that change the conversation? Possibly for a while, but then other issues come up. And ecologists that I speak to talk about the environment is often, given such a low priority behind, for instance, defense, education, transport, health, and the like. And they say that, look, until the voter starts to care, nothing's going to change. And if, for instance, that mass bleaching didn't really make a permanent shift in the conversation in Australia, it is a question about whether these bushfires will make that sort of a shift. But anyone who's paying any close attention, I suppose, to the way that we fund environmental care in Australia, whether it's through the monitoring or other kinds of research, will notice that these budgets tend to decrease over time. And the debate that's being whipped up, if you like, by the Prime Minister is about treating this as an opportunity to increase, for example, vegetation burning, the so-called hazard reduction burns, as a way of maybe dealing with the threat that fires pose to property and people. While there's a sentiment, I suppose, about protecting the community, which is always going to be paramount, it's hardly going to maintain the kinds of ecosystems we've had in the past. For example, Richard Kingsford, who heads the University of New South Wales' Centre for Ecosystem Science, was telling me just yesterday, the environments we're looking at are not the environments that our grandchildren are going to look at. And he's probably right. So as a community, we're going to have to weigh these things up. What is it that we really want to care about and to preserve for future generations? What's the cost of that? What's the science telling us about either priorities, both in terms of hazard reduction burning, but also the priorities in terms of maintaining viable ecosystems that ultimately, frankly, the rest of the economy is going to depend on sooner or later?
I think going off that, these fires have provided a really unique opportunity for firefighters and fire ecologists and scientists to really learn about, regeneration and fire behaviour. I've been speaking to a couple of fire ecologists and people in the RFS, and they're saying, this is an opportunity to look at how we predict what's going to happen. It's an opportunity to learn how fires behave and how we can map their behaviour and make sure, the next time this happens, we're prepared and we are at a place where we can better understand what's coming. So I think, stepping aside from what Peter's been saying, this is a very unique opportunity to kind of learn about mass fire and mass regeneration, and hopefully that can help us the next time something like this happens.
Well, Laura, Peter, thank you very much for your time on the story that is not going to go away. It's only going to get bigger, and thank you again. Thanks so much to our Please Explain guests this week, environment editor Peter Hannum and Laura Chung, urban affairs reporter, both from the City Morning Herald. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the City Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe the City Morning Herald or The Age. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Additional audio support from Anu Hasbold. Amelia McGuire manages the logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Chris Sapone. Thank you for listening.